Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama has unveiled the new face America will show the world. And it's Hillary Clinton and President Bush's current Defense Secretary Robert Gates, African-American confidant Susan Rice at the UN, Marine General and McCain buddy Jim Jones for National Security Advisor. It's a team picked, Obama says, on its merits.
We have to recall that when it comes to keeping our nation and our people safe, we are not Republicans or Democrats. We are Americans. There's no monopoly of power or wisdom in either party.
Well, there will be a lot of power here. Obama has promised to use it in new ways. How will it work? We'll ask this hour On Point Obama's new national security team and how it may shape America's way in the world. You can join the conversation. Is this your dream team? Clinton, Gates, Jones, a new Rice, Eric Holder as AG, Napolitano as Homeland Security. Is Barack Obama loaded for change here, for success? We've got a great panel with us today. From New York, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Katrina, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
From Washington, David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, author of Body of Lies, see it in theaters now. David, great to have you back as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from Monterey, California, John Arquilla is with us, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He was an advisor to the Obama campaign, but did not endorse the candidate because of his Navy ties. His latest book, A Grand-Scale Critique of the Military's Current Structure, is called Worst Enemy, The Reluctant Transformation of the American Military. John, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you all. David Ignatius, first to you. Headline on your blog this morning, Obama's all-star roster. But you weren't always so sure. How do you see this team, David?
Well, it is an all-star team. These are very impressive individuals. My concern from the moment that it appeared that Hillary Clinton was the likely choice for Secretary of State was that because she is a superstar, she might in some ways reduce the personal imprint that President-elect Obama will have on foreign policy. I think he has a unique opportunity because of who he is, what he symbolizes, the way in which he says to the world, we're turning a page, we're a new America, to do things that are important. And the idea of subcontracting that foreign policy responsibility to such a powerful person in Hillary Clinton, who comes with talents but also a lot of baggage, I wondered if that was a wise choice. Seeing them yesterday as they presented the team, I was struck by the dominant role that Obama had. I thought he spoke with great confidence. There was no question watching that group of powerful people who was in charge. When he said the buck will stop here with him, he seemed convincing in that. So, you know, I think
the body language and the weight of his decision-making responsibility really on his face yesterday in Chicago.
I felt that he looked – I wrote this morning – he looked more presidential, and by that I meant a face more creased with lines of worry. The weight of responsibility that's coming shows on him in a way that I think is not unbecoming. To close this out on the all-star roster,
mm-hmm.
I've been covering foreign policy for many years, several decades, and I've seen all-star teams crack up again and again. This problem of managing big, talented egos, each wanting to make their imprint on foreign policy, is really difficult. And it requires, above all, a national security advisor who's a good mediator, broker, traffic cop. But ultimately, it requires a president who makes decisions. I saw George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger during the Reagan administration practically come to blows because they were so angry and the national security advisor couldn't stop that. We saw the same thing, to be honest, in the George W. Bush administration, mm-hmm. between Colin Powell and Cheney and Rumsfeld. So, you know, there's lots of reasons to applaud the all-stars but also to worry a little bit.
There are egos that will be at work here, also instincts and outlooks. Katrina, John, I'll come to you. Let's listen for just a moment to Barack Obama yesterday introducing a team that he said would have conflicting opinions.
I assembled this team because I'm a strong believer in strong personalities and strong opinions. I think that's how the best decisions are made. One of the dangers in a White House, based on my reading of history, is that you get wrapped up in groupthink, and everybody agrees with everything, and there's no discussion, and there are no dissenting views. So I'm going to be welcoming a vigorous debate inside the White House. But understand, I will be setting policy as president.
Barack Obama in Chicago yesterday, quoting Harry Truman, the buck, he said, "We'll stop with me, Katrina Vandenhoevel. You've pointed out in the progressive neck of the woods, no small amount of concern about whether or not Obama's got a progressive enough cabinet going. Your own headline not long ago was Robert Gates, wrong man for the job. What did you see on that stage?"
Well, Tom, let me just begin by saying we see change in the relief from the arrogance and the destructiveness of Bush's foreign policy and the possibility which Obama has brought of America becoming a source of hope, not fear, America reengaging with the world, not known for Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo or torture, but for engaging in positive, constructive ways with diplomacy. My concern is that despite the talk of not wanting groupthink, wanting a broad range of opinion, to me on that stage, you not only saw not a single person, with the exception of Susan Rice, who is going to the UN in New York, so will not be in the White House, not a single one of those people opposed the war in Iraq, a strategic blunder that is the greatest in U.S. foreign policy history. And I think that is telling because Obama has spoken importantly about not only having the good judgment to oppose the war in Iraq, but, quote, "I want to end the mindset that got us into war." So I'm concerned about the narrow bandwidth of this team of not rivals, but outside personalities and egos. And David Ignatius makes a point about the need for working together for, you know, the pragmatism, the competence. But I think what we're seeing at this point is the possibility of reengaging the world through treaties, instruments which the Bush administration thought were destructive. But on one of the key issues facing this administration, Afghanistan, who in this White House is speaking about not escalating militarily and the whole future of the Obama presidency, not to be too big here, but I believe it depends on rethinking Obama's commitment to increase American military forces in Afghanistan, which may just bog us down in his administration in an unwinnable war, draining resources desperately needed and draining room for other international initiatives. So I'm worried about the narrow bandwidth, and that to me was apparent on that stage in Washington, despite Barack Obama's the possibility, as David Ignatius said, of truly reinvigorating America's engagement with a world which seeks partnership, not necessarily American dominance.
But Barack Obama not backing off one bit on Afghanistan anywhere yet, certainly not yesterday. John Arquilla, I guess there's so many questions here, but a couple of big ones. I mean, one is how that tableau looks, the all-star team that's put up there. The other is what it will do. How do you interpret what you saw on the stage and the policy that may come out of that team of, if not rivals, and certainly big powerhouses, egos, John?
Well, it's wonderful political theater. Obama is clearly telling the American people he wants to get beyond partisan bickering. The problem with the defense area is that we actually need thoughtful debate right now and sharp and divergent views. This is not the team that's going to give you the conflicting opinions that the president-elect wants. They're going to give you how did General Jones put it? His job will be to raise consensus. That's important. How about arriving at consensus? Generals like to raise things. I think a national security advisor wants to help arrive at them. But in Secretary Gates, you will find a continuance of a troubling trajectory in a lot of areas that's going to keep the Pentagon at about a $2 billion a day spending level. In General Jones, you'll keep on. Remember now, some of his very senior advisors during his career are the people who invented the idea of shock and awe bombing and spoke admiringly of the Hiroshima example as a way to shock and awe people into submission. And he is, of course, calling for more troops to Afghanistan. A lot of the people on this team, for them, strategic affairs are all a numbers game. General Jones went out of his way to say that Iraq needed a lot more troops. Well, of course, we've got violence down by 80% there. So how is it we needed all these more troops? We basically have the same number we've had all along. And my point would be that the surge is a kind of Rorschach test for strategists. If you believe that it was all about numbers, then of course you want to raise the size of the forces. And the president-elect has said he's going to raise the size of the Army by over 60,000, the active Marine force by about 30,000. It's all becoming strategy as a numbers game. Now, didn't we learn in Vietnam a generation back that you could surge up to 600,000 troops, and if you had the wrong concept of operations, you'd lose? The reason things got better in Iraq was that we used different methods, what I started calling outpost and outreach 4 years ago, tiny posts and negotiating with insurgents, and was pilloried for this for a few years. When it was tried, it worked almost immediately.
And yet, John, isn't Robert Gates one who's talked quite a bit, and kind of in the face of the Bush administration, about less reliance on military, more on diplomacy, more on outreach?
Well, everybody wants to do more diplomacy. Where the rubber meets the road is, what program will you stop? Will you put an end to the Gerald R. Ford class, the $100 billion investment in new carriers and the ships for them? Do you really need a larger active force? For 60 years, we've been drawing down the active force. Now they want to increase it. And it seems to me that what President-elect Obama is not going to get is that articulate opposing voice on these points. He's got people marching in lockstep in a conventional wisdom here that I think is politically soothing to the American people, but highly inimical to our interests as a country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Barack Obama's national security team, Pentagon, State, and White House, Gates, Clinton, Jones, and more, and what it promises for America's posture in the world, for American change. Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation is with us, David Ignatius from The Washington Post, and John Arquilla from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. Here's Hillary Clinton yesterday on that stage next to Barack Obama in Chicago.
By electing Barack Obama our next president, the American people have demanded not just a new direction at home, but a new effort to renew America's standing in the world as a force for positive change. We know our security, our values, and our interests cannot be protected and advanced by force alone.
Hillary Clinton yesterday, nominated now by Obama to be Secretary of State. Everybody, of course, has to have confirmations here, but let's take it right from the top. David Ignatius, how about Hillary Clinton? You were concerned about the baggage she brings, maybe about Bill Clinton, about him losing some of his luster or FaceTime marquee to the world, but there she's going to be in terms of her presence and her view of the world. How do you anticipate her impact on the Obama years?
Well, there are several areas in which she obviously disagreed with Obama when they were running in the primaries. An important area to focus on, I think, is Iran, because Iran is the next really difficult security problem the U.S. will face. Obama has been an advocate of dialogue and engagement with Iran. Mm. Clinton has been more confrontational in her rhetoric, certainly in her vote to target the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. I just would like to return to something that John and, mm-hmm. and Katrina were talking about, which is to what extent are we likely to see some debate and dissent within this group? Certainly, Obama's pitch for his all-stars was that he wants lively discussion. He doesn't want everybody cut by the same cookie cutter. I do think that there's more debate going on right now about where to go in Afghanistan, for example, than the earlier discussion implied. Gates, for example, has been somewhat, I think, increasingly skeptical that more troops per se are the answer. Mm. He has supported three additional brigades for Afghanistan. But what I hear is not so much that troops are going to do it, but that some increase in troops is a prelude to a real effort to negotiate, to reach out and try to draw in elements of the Taliban, as General Petraeus likes mm-hmm. to call them, the reconcilables. And I think that's the thrust going forward among the uniformed military, with Gates, I think with most people who are looking at the Afghanistan problem. There may be more troops next year, but that's not the focus of where people are looking. So I think there's already a livelier debate than was implied. I think the lesson that people are taking from Iraq, as John would want them to take, is that it's not the numbers, but how you use people. It's the use of counterinsurgency tactics. It's the ability to draw in tribes, to understand the tribes, draw them in, work with them, and in that sense, take them off the battlefield through negotiation, not through fighting.
So there's Gates on. Yes, John.
Then why send more troops if that's the case? Mm-hmm. See, my concern is that this conventional wisdom always associates things with greater numbers. And in a place like Afghanistan, the greater numbers create enormous, enormous resistance from the people. This is a proud people that really haven't been ruled by anybody, running from Alexander the Great in ancient times to Alexander Lebed in Soviet occupation times. And the bigger our footprint, the worse we wear out our welcome. Mm. So I would emphasize the methods used and not simply the numbers game part. And unfortunately, everybody on this team is a numbers game person. So at least I would hope that we'd have that debate. And David is right that Secretary Gates has been the one voice here. And some of the plans that are going forward at the Central Command do include keeping force levels where they are. And one option does consider even a smaller force. And of course, there's even some the whole point is there's a lot of debate inside the defense community about how low we can go and have stability, including in places like Iraq. Maybe we could draw down very deep very quickly and keep a small footprint for a very much longer time, and this would be more palatable to the Iraqis.
Katrina, how about...
I was going to say, I think John makes the right point. I mean, this idea of a sort of small surge and negotiate, you're still playing the numbers game. And I think what the broader point here, and it relates to a topic that is just off the table completely. There's no debate inside this administration or inside the Republican or Democratic Party about a military budget, which is now almost $600 billion, not counting Iraq and Afghanistan, I believe, almost as large as the combined military budgets of the rest of the world. And the question that we should draw from our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan is not that we need more conventional forces, but that the missions of regime change and counterinsurgency are, in addition to being illegal in the case of the former and unethical, not essential to U.S. interest and cannot be achieved at acceptable cost. And I don't see anyone inside this team even having that on the radar. And the idea of reducing America's heavy footprint in the Islamic world, I think that is crucial, not only for freeing resources for more urgent domestic and international needs, but again, it isn't something that seems part of this team's mindset. And I think that should disturb all Americans who, coming out of Iraq, have learned in instinctive gut and other ways the limits of military power, the limits of U.S. power. And finally, as we look ahead to the 21st century, this team does have on its agenda climate change. It has a sense of international treaties. But how is an increased military force useful for global economic instability, for combating nuclear proliferation, for energy resource shortages, which this intelligence report came out talking about last week,
right?
Global Trends 2025. I think that is a crucial blueprint for a national security team to understand the challenges moving ahead into this next period, which isn't necessarily in the portfolio of the people we're looking at.
And yet Obama's got to deal with politics and perception at the same time. Let's hear from our listeners. David in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well.
I'm totally sympathetic with Ms. VandenHeuvel and Mr. Aquila, and I hope that their views get more and more hearing in the administration. But I, you know, as a Obama backer, I'm willing to cut him a little slack, or a lot of slack. I wonder if we could reconvene in a year and find out see what he's done. But Obama's really seems to me to be unusually smart about engineering a new center on all this and a lot of other subjects. And I think what he's doing with Gates, who's somebody with a lot of great Republican credentials, who's actually thinking along the same lines and, can't now say, we're going to cut all these unnecessary and expensive military projects, but probably wants to do that and can find a way to do it without alienating the military establishment. And I don't know, but I hope that that's what's going on here, that
a kind of Nixon to China dynamic with
yeah.
Gates and Obama out to the mainstream.
Yeah, in this case, China being the military industrial
establishment,
complex.
Right? David Ignatius, how about it? Do you see a real change agent in Robert Gates, or a product of the Cold War, who's going to sort of guard those perceptions that path, even with Obama?
Gates has been, to a surprising extent, a change agent in his nearly 2 years as defense secretary. You just, as somebody who follows the Pentagon, you cannot overstate the change from Rumsfeld and Rumsfeld's arrogance and mismanagement to Gates's bringing a degree of accountability. He's fired two service secretaries who weren't doing the job when the Army didn't take the wounded at Walter Reed seriously. The Army secretary got fired when the Air Force let loose nukes roam around the country and didn't take it seriously. Both the chief of staff of the Air Force mm-hmm. and the secretary got fired. Gates has been a critic. Gates has wanted to have lower troop levels in Iraq and has been really arguing with General Petraeus about this for a year. In the end, he ended up acceding and let the troop levels stay higher than he initially wanted. He has been, I think, increasingly skeptical about Afghanistan. He argues more forcefully than anybody in this government that the answer to our problems is not military power, but is greater use of civilian power. The State Department doesn't have a better friend, paradoxically, than the Secretary of Defense.
Is he willing to give up military budget, Pentagon budget, to support that State Department?
We'll see, but he's been very aggressive in trying to cut back Pentagon spending that he thinks is wasteful. He thinks all the money, or much of the money that we're spending to get ready for a hypothetical war with China, all the things the Navy would love to buy, the Air Force would love to buy to get ready for that imaginary war, he's really been an opponent of that. He keeps stressing the need for low-cost platforms, unmanned surveillance planes that can do the job that expensive, fancy jets can do. So he's been more of a change agent. I think it's very interesting that Obama saw that. An Obama advisor said to me at one point, you know, when we listen to Bob Gates, we think he's a lot closer to us than he is to the Bush administration. That's why they decided they wanted him.
John Arquilla, do you think Robert Gates will willingly take U.S. forces out of Iraq on Barack Obama's stated timetable?
Oh, I think we can even beat that timetable and go a lot lower than people realize. Even today, we've had an 80% reduction in violence there over the past year, and only about 10% of our troops in country, maybe 15,000, are actually either in the small outposts with Iraqis or supporting them. We didn't need the surge. We don't need as many troops as we have there now, so we could begin cutting that huge $10 billion a month expenditure there.
So you say, but do you think Secretary Gates agrees?
Well, I think David Ignatius is right that Secretary Gates has brought a whole new tone into the Pentagon, and what's happened is a lot of these of discordant voices, in which I include myself in that Greek chorus, are getting a lot more airing at higher levels, and I think there is a real openness to change. What I don't see are the line items in the budget going away on those legacy systems that really, that's where the heart of the budget lies, where, as I said, the Gerald R. Ford class of carriers are associated
super
with
carriers.
About $100 billion in spending, and there are a variety of systems, the F-22, the Future Combat System. I don't want to get into a lot of military jargon here, but all of that remains and continues to have his imprimatur. So he's walking a fine line, and I think actually David's right that he has a chance to blossom here in a very interesting way, and it's perhaps the most hopeful part. It's funny that the most hopeful part of this cabinet he's rolling out is the holdover guy.
Fascinating.
Could
Katrina?
A slightly dissenting point. First of all, I do agree with your listener that Barack Obama has not assumed the presidency yet, and he has had the ability to engineer a new center, but much of that comes from what's going on in this country and around the world. There is a new center. I mean, in the economy, I would argue a new centrism means massive economic stimulus programs and government intervention in the economy. I do think in the case of Gates, however, what we're seeing in a broader perspective is a return to a bipartisan foreign policy of the Clinton and Bush 1 years. We've had such a radical, I hate to dirty that word, but such an extreme neocon twist in these last years with a slight return to a bipartisan foreign policy with Gates coming back to defense in these last months, that we forget that that's the change we may well be looking at with some modest improvements. I do believe that, you know, progressives need to be as pragmatic and clear-eyed and tough about Barack Obama as he is about us. He is who he is, and it will require movement and change in the world to push in some of the directions John and I have been talking about. I would note one thing, however. I do think on core issues such as nuclear nonproliferation, Barack Obama has spoken boldly, in sync, ironically, with people like Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, and Sam Nunn, about moving toward a nuclear-free world. Robert Gates has been talking recently about building a new generation of nuclear weapons. Who needs that in this world? That is destabilizing, particularly at a time when we are on the cusp of what I would call a new Cold War, and we need a strategic partnership, not a friendship, a partnership with Russia, which can help us deal with Iran, with intelligence, with extricating from Afghanistan, a whole slew of things. And Bill Gates is a veteran Cold Warrior, and those genes don't leave too quickly.
Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Ted. Hi, Ted, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks.
Yeah.
I have two quick questions. One is how the guests feel this panel that was marched out there yesterday will stand on the missile defense system in the Czech Republic and Poland. And the other question is, why is it that folks like Barack Obama, with the people that carried him in to this office in the beginning, not at the end, but in the beginning, would be maybe, pretty far left of center, I guess. It seems like he's kind of ashamed of some of the people that got him there. Well, I feel like people like Bush were very proud of the evangelicals and that type of person that got them where they were. And
Ted, those are great questions. Both our time is short before the break. David, let me put the last one there to you. This sort of centering that Barack Obama is doing. Ted's reading it as shame in the flag he first flew. But how do you see it?
I didn't see shame in Obama. I saw a lot of confidence. This is a more centrist team. By conventional definitions, than some people might have expected. I've sensed in different ways since the election Obama really reckoning with the reality that this man with relatively little experience now has responsibility for the country in a time of real crisis, at a time when we're fighting, trying to wind down two wars. He wants good advice. He wants good advice from strong people. I think the fact that he sent Susan Rice to the UN is smart because the world does want to see change. I mean, the two channel markers for me with Obama are change on the one hand. He is a force for change, and a cautious nature. He is a judicious man, and so he will steer between those two, change and caution. I don't think that's a bad stance, to be honest, in a world with as many dangerous things going on as we see now. And, you know, he's got – I mean, the question is, does he have people to push him to do innovative things, to take risks, to be different, to show the world a different face? At the same time, he has people saying, oh, you can't take those troops out quite as quickly, Mr. President, as you may have wanted. He's got to have both.
Change and caution. Katrina, we've got 10 seconds before the break. Can you have it both ways?
I don't see people inside here who will push Barack Obama to take risks. I do think we need some boldness, certainly innovation in our foreign policy. And I would argue that when we talk about experience, let's also look at the quality of that experience. That is allied with good judgment, which Barack Obama had on Iraq. But listen, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld had experience, and let's redefine experience not to be inside the Beltway.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama's newly nominated national security team, from Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Robert Gates from the W. Bush administration, right on into Obama, if everything goes the way Obama hopes, and right on down, half a dozen big positions yesterday, those nominees on stage in Chicago. With us this hour, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation, John Arquilla, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School and author of Worst Enemy, The Reluctant Transformation of the American Military. Standing very tall on that stage yesterday, he's a big guy, General James Jones, former NATO commander, Marine general, picked as Obama's national security advisor. He'll be in the White House at the elbow of the president-elect. Here he is, decorated Marine veteran, speaking yesterday.
National security in the 21st century comprises a portfolio which includes all elements of our national power and influence, working in coordination and harmony towards the desired goal of keeping our nation safe, helping to make our world a better place, and providing opportunity to live in peace and security for the generations to follow.
General James Jones yesterday. David Ignatius, a lot of people talking about how important this role always is and will be in particular with such big players around the table under Obama. Why so? What's the key factor here?
One clear lesson of the last 20 or 30 years is that when you have strong cabinet secretaries, especially in the national security area, it is crucial to have a strong national security advisor who can act as a broker, a traffic cop. The inability to do that ended up really crippling the Reagan administration in its middle years. And Condi Rice's failure as national security advisor is one of the real causes of the difficulties the Bush administration experienced.
Failure. Failure to what? To maneuver failure, all those big bolts.
Failure to coordinate the often sharply conflicting views of the Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, and the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, with Dick Cheney, the vice president, as a kind of roving linebacker busting in whenever he wanted. This was part of the foreign policy trouble of that period. So everybody knows you need a strong national security advisor if you're going to have a strong team like this. Jim Jones, you know, to look at him, he's a great big strapping Marine. Nobody's going to mess with him. Is he also going to be the kind of strategist and kind of roving secret emissary that Brzezinski or Kissinger was? Mm-hmm. I actually think that's needed now. There's so many opportunities, so many issues to sort out. You got to have somebody on the plane trying to figure that. Is Jim Jones that person? I don't know. But on the traffic cop role, yeah, I think he'll be very good.
Katrina, what about the dynamics, the team dynamic here?
I was going to tease David and say you don't think Bill Clinton can be that roving ambassador for this administration.
Yeah, we've got to
send
him
around
to
the world.
Well, not the man I think of as an invisible emissary, no.
But yeah, that's probably part of what General Jones is going to have to keep his eye on here, right?
Well, that's right. But let me if I could, strike another discordant note, though I do wish I could be cordant. the militarization of our foreign policy is something we should think long and hard about. And I do think by putting General Jones in this position, you have a strapping Marine. And I think we should reflect on that. I'd also say, even though I think this idea of bipartisanship has its value and its limits, at a moment after, Democrats have been viewed as, quote, soft on national security and defense, Obama keeps Gates on, and it raises a question about does it send a message that even Democrats agree that Democrats can't run the military? Hmm. And again, it's I think we need a reassertion of civilian control. John may disagree that may not be a serious issue, but it is worth thinking about if we want to have a foreign policy that is far more about diplomacy, quote, soft power, than our military might.
Play this through with us for a second. Think about that in terms for a moment of Hillary Clinton. She's the civilian wing of this outreach to the world. Gates and Jones have both talked about making much greater use of civilian resources. But does that mean militarization of the State Department?
Here's what I think is going on with Gates, and I think he has traveled the country and spoken wisely about the need to fund the State Department diplomacy more aggressively. What we're looking at is over the last 10 years, and David, John may know more about this, but a fairly radical shift of funding and power has gone from state to defense. So it's essentially a reassertion of a more important State Department role with the adequate funding to do that. So it's a reset. It's not necessarily an advance, but it suggests that Gates does understand that we need to bring diplomacy back after the ravaging of that to the Bush administration.
John Aquila, if General Jones is the traffic cop, how do you see him waving the different resources around here and people?
Well, I think generals, first of all, like to boil away the differences. As General Jones himself said yesterday, his job is to raise consensus. That's important. So I'm a little concerned. A national security officer should be, advisor should be fostering debate, and I think The problem here is we're going to be listening to generals a lot more. We've just spent the last several years with a president who said to BBC yesterday that he wasn't prepared to be a wartime president, and as commander-in-chief spent all his time, quote, listening to his generals. It almost seemed like General Petraeus was a big part of the presidential campaign this last fall. We listened to our generals, and I think listening to our generals often gets us into trouble because their perspective is naturally a little narrower than a Zbigniew Brzezinski or a Henry Kissinger's. Mm-hmm. And so I think intellectually it would have made more sense to go with either of those models than this approach. And I think the only advice I would have for the president-elect is that he likes to read about Lincoln. Well, he needs to read the part where Lincoln had to fight against his generals for years to get the right strategy going in the Civil War. His generals all wanted to mass enormous forces in one place and have climactic battles, and they managed to lose most of those. Lincoln understood that the railroad and the telegraph allowed you to distribute your forces all over a mm-hmm. battleground as big as Western Europe and command and control them. And he went to the telegraph office every single day. And he had to keep sacking generals until he found one who was slightly inebriated but willing to do what he asked. And that's how they won the war. And I think if President-elect Obama is going to be reading more Lincoln, it needs to be about Lincoln as a strategist. I think it was a mistake to go with yet another general's voice.
David Ignatius, project into the Oval Office a little bit here. Imagine you've got Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton. These are no shrinking violets. Do you see them slavishly listening to generals or something else?
Well, certainly not slavishly, but I think they will listen to generals, and they should. One thing that I've been struck by over the last few years is how much our generals, the commanders, mm-hmm. have learned from experience. One of the most stunning accounts of Iraq is a history written by the U.S. Army about the Army's failures in the first few years and what it learned it needed to do differently. I think General Petraeus is an example of this. He made a lot of mistakes himself in Iraq, and I think he learned from them. And I see that throughout the military. So what the president's going to get from the military is advice seasoned by bitter, bitter experience of things not having gone right. I don't see a lot of enthusiasm among most senior military officers for the idea that saturating Southwest Asia with more U.S. troops is a good idea. I think they understand as well as John or as well as Katrina that reducing the U.S. footprint is crucial to our national security, that we are just too unpopular in that part of the world. So listening to generals isn't a bad idea per se. The one thing I'd like to see in this team that I don't see is a sort of world-class strategist, strategic thinker. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody like Zbigniew Brzezinski, somebody like Brent Scowcroft, who, quiet though he is a real strategist. I don't see that. I think they need it. I think maybe that's the role for Obama as a sort of strategist in chief, because I don't see the advisor who's cut out.
Is there one a layer down, one in the wings, one that's just not visible yet, or no?
David, you don't think that Mr. Vice President Biden thinks of himself as that strategist in chief?
I mean, you mentioned Cheney.
You mentioned Cheney earlier, and I worry about. I mean, I again think Biden is very much part of this team in the sense that he's not going to provide a dissenting strategic or other opinion. I do think one of the great challenges facing this country and. David, John may disagree, is the relationship with Russia. And I think Joe Biden on NATO expansion, which is going to be a big issue moving quickly, has not shown any smart thinking. And that's the limits, again, of Inside the Beltway experience. But he's not a dissident voice by any means. And I agree with David that we need a strategist. But I have to say, disagree that generals have learned as much as David thinks. I mean, there is a view still that the surge was a success, and that may well color what we see in Afghanistan with this small surge in order to negotiate, which should not, in my view, proceed.
We've got a lot of questions from our listeners. Let me turn to some. Diane in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Diane.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'll be brief. I just have a concern about Hillary Clinton. I like her a lot, but as far as the appropriateness of her being appointed Secretary of State, I'm just concerned because I recall her in the past as having said, even when she was married to Bill, she's still married to him, when she was the First Lady, and beyond that, describing herself as having close emotional and personal ties to Israel stemming from her college days. And in the past, the U.S. has stood with Israel against the entire world at times, you know, in the United Nations, for example. And I'm just wondering if she's going to be able to be an impartial broker with the Middle East, because I see that's like a key problem and a way that the United States could change a little bit is not being perceived as being totally pro-Israel, and I'm really worried about that.
Diane, let us pick it up. John Arquilla, this feeds into some streams of your thinking. What do you see there?
In the case of Hillary Clinton and foreign policy, what I see again is it's not a new center, it's the old center that's reasserting itself. And I think that I would go back to Katrina's point. We're on a collision course with Russia over NATO. Ted's question earlier about ballistic missile defense in Central or Eastern Europe is going to be extremely provocative. By the way, there's another technology we're spending billions on each year that still, mm-hmm. 25 years after Star Wars speech, doesn't work. And all you get is something that doesn't work. You get all the antagonism for none of the function. And I think President-elect Obama has been listening to his vice presidents, to his national security advisor, and others, and taken us on a course that is bound, if not a new Cold War, at least a cool war with the Russians.
What about Diane's Israel question when it comes to
Hillary Clinton? In my view, one of the smartest things George W. Bush did at the outset of his presidency was to say that he was going to allow the Palestinians and the Israelis to want peace more than we wanted them to want peace. I think that's a direct quote because of the grammar. And that made a great deal of sense. We should be ready to implement a peace, but inserting ourselves in the middle of it is a guarantee of spending all of your presidential capital for basically no returns. This is an extremely hard problem in the world, and I think we have to allow the Israelis and the Palestinians to work it out. And I think, you know, the caller's right. We are going to get far too deeply in the middle once again, and I would hate to see the president-elect's political capital expended quickly and wastefully on a problem that others have to solve.
Of course, many have said over the years that it won't be solved without U.S. Intervention.
We've intervened a long time, and it hasn't solved. Let's try taking our fingers out of the dike and see what happens.
Let's go to Leesburg, Virginia, and Jawad. Jawad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question for your panelists about the Afghanistan part of your discussion.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the stakes for the U.S. and NATO member countries are so high that they are not going to leave that country in the near future. And as you know, we see in the past 7 years, about $150 billion or so has been spent, and there's nothing really there to show for. So I'm wondering, you know, what do your panelists think about the possibility of a Marshall Plan there, you know, that will help, you know, the Afghan government to stand on its feet and, you know, develop a strategic economy so that in the next 20 years, you know, 30 years, it can stand on its own feet rather than spending all the money on buying bullets.
Jawad, let me table that question for just a minute. The mini Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, there's been a lot of talk about development there, but not as much money. Let me put that to the side for just a second and get a call from Ravi in Boston. Ravi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for your panelists with respect to India. We recently had a lot of terrorist attacks.
Mumbai, sure.
Yeah, and this time it has been pretty daring because the targets were Westerners and a Jewish center in Mumbai.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time when the intelligence reports in India points to cross-border elements, the United States policy has been one of restraint and asking India to, you know, negotiate with Pakistan,
right,
and not pursue the same hot pursuit option that United States does in Afghanistan or anything like that. So will this change? I mean, like, will this be more of the same, or would India be allowed to defend itself from terrorist attacks more?
Our time is short. Let us pick those up. David Ignatius, there's one Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. More likely here are the resources there. And what about hot pursuit for India? Barack Obama criticized, you know, John McCain, saying he'd go to the gates of hell but not to the cave where Obama lives. Would the U.S. sign off on hot pursuit for India and Pakistan?
Well, first, on the Marshall Plan, it's hard to have a Marshall Plan when you have a war going on. You need a degree of security to make these reconstruction plans work.
But hard to win without it, apparently.
It's hard to win without it. That's what we've been trying to do in Afghanistan with the provincial reconstruction teams. They're having varying levels of success, but in eastern Afghanistan, you can see the difference that new roads make in provinces like Kunar. On the question of hot pursuit, we just during our broadcast, the Washington Post moved a story that Pakistan has offered a joint investigation with India of this terrorist attack to work their intelligence services, other resources together. That's the way, presumably, that everybody needs to go. The idea that India should emulate the U.S. and strike unilaterally against targets in Pakistan seems absolutely crazy to me.
But it's also crazy that the hot pursuit of the U.S. into Pakistan, because I think it raises the double standard your listener points out. I would argue on the mini Marshall Plan, David's probably right, that mini Marshall Plan is too grand. But I do think what's required, and I think within the Obama team, there are elements of his advisors who understand you need regional diplomacy to resolve Afghanistan. Listen, the Soviets had triple the number of troops we did. They were ensnared and forced to leave. So targeted economic aid, regional diplomacy, and we possibly look at a rift with our NATO allies if we continue to escalate. So regional diplomacy all the way around, including the good news, David reports, that there seems to be a joint investigative team between Pakistan and India to defuse that crisis.
Well, a big and big-shouldered team on the stage yesterday. It's going to be absolutely fascinating to see how the guy where the buck stops, Barack Obama, deals with the issues and personalities all around him there. Katrina VandenHeuvel with The Nation, John Arquilla at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and David Ignatius with The Washington Post. Thanks to each of you for being with us this hour. Great having you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.